tape, okay, who was saying that the nature of a person is that he doesn't want to accept the fact that that how he lives his life so much is dependent on his personality. We're not saying you can't make changes. We're not saying you can't be guided by chachma, and you can make great changes in your life. But the fact is, a large part of who you are is determined by your personality, and your personality is the basic foundation of your personality is the early years of youth, plus your genes. So therefore, the problem is not the depth of this idea. It's not a difficult idea to see and understand. You see, if you look around, you see people with their personalities. If you look at kindergarten kids playing, watch the way they act to each other. Then look at high school kids, there's not much difference. An adult, there is a change, because an adult learns to cover up their emotions. It's not that they don't have the same emotions as the kindergarten kid. They still have the same personality. But at a certain point, you learn to cover up your feelings and hide your feelings. You see? So, but it's not that you change your personality. You're still the same person. So you see, if you really look around you, you see free will is not so easy as it seems. You see, because you're really guided by who you are, okay? But you have the ability, if raised properly, if you have the ability to be able to get out of the framework in which you're operating in and change that framework. And even if it's not completely changed, but you can change it to a large extent, how you operate, by lowering the emotional impact and being guided by chachma, by wisdom. See, the thing is that if somebody is evil, I don't know how much you could blame them. The reason why they're punished is for one of two reasons. Either they're punished by God, which we don't have the right to do. They're punished by God to help them change their personality. What do I mean? God puts you in situations that you're forced to deal with your personality. Now, either you deal with your personality correctly and it's a benefit, or it will destroy you. You know what I mean? That we don't have the right to do. That we don't have the right to do. But however, the courts, the only reason why we punish you insofar as court is concerned is because we have to protect society. So therefore, we protect society, but it shouldn't be condemnation like it's his fault. You don't know. Maybe it's his fault, maybe it's not. Only God could decide how much was his fault, how much is not. You understand? But the fact is that we only have the right to decide whether he should be controlled because he's a menace to society, he's harmful to society, or whether God will decide whether he can put him in a situation. We have the right to educate a person, and like Rabbeinu Yehuda said before, that even then you have to make the decision who you should educate, you see? But we do not have the right to put a person in a situation to help change his personality. Only God has that right.
On tape one of this series of the Mishlei Rabbeinu Yehuda, I mentioned a question in Shalach about Rashi that talks about the connection between the last parsha and this parsha, and I brought that Rashi showed the question, it showed the similar question by in Makos by the story of Rabbi Akiva. And then I brought the two psukim from Tehillim, from the Psalms, about the idea of the another idea. I'd like to answer the questions that I asked slightly differently than I answered before. All right, the first thing is the Psalms. that a fool is a person that doesn't accept a certain reality. Well, he's not aware of a certain reality. Okay? In this case, he's not aware that the best possible life that the physical world has to offer is the Torah life. That's not real to him. And so therefore, King David calls him a fool. Okay? But however, the next level is where you study Torah, and you study the philosophy of Torah, and you start seeing the benefit of the Torah life, and you truly see the God's system and how it really works, and that the wicked will fail and that the tzaddik will be successful. Alright? But however, so the question is, what is the story of Rabbi Akiva? Why was he happy when he saw the fox come through? Because in the story of Rabbi Akiva, that was scientific proof that the Torah is correct. First, there's only my mind, and my mind sees the interpretation of Torah. And that gives me a certain level of reality. But a higher level of reality is where I see God's system actually operating in the physical world, and therefore it makes it more real to me, because I see that God's system really works. Now, insofar as Rashi on Shalach is concerned, there are two types of people that fail in this world. One is the Rasha, the wicked person fails. So you could see it in that way. But also, when the righteous, when they do something wrong, you see that God doesn't overlook their wrong. Sometimes you'd say, God is not going to punish him because he's a tzaddik. It's not true. It's God, you see, by Miriam, who was on a very, very high level of prophecy, and yet when she did something wrong, she was punished. She was punished. So therefore, and the people that went, the spies, were the leaders of the community. They were the Nesi'im. And so therefore, they saw Egypt, they saw the desert, they saw all the miracles, they really saw God's system really working. Here they had a proof that God doesn't overlook even the righteous when they sin or they do something wrong. God does not overlook it. Here was scientific proof. It could have been a higher level of reality that God's system works, not only from the studying of Torah, but the scientific proof of the that really happened here. And yet these people did not learn from this. They didn't learn from the Torah, and then not only that, they did not learn from scientific proof that God's system really works, and therefore you should be very careful of not sinning. And so therefore these people are not fools, these people are Rishoyim, they are wicked. Because they could have gotten the scientific proof, because they know the system, and they didn't. And so therefore the Rashi calls them Rishoyim. The Pasuk test, it says, Ki Libyas Cheinem L'Roshecha, because it's a garland of grace around your head, Anakam L'Gagrosecha, and a necklace for your neck. In the middle of Rabbeinu Yonan, the Pasuk test, he says, V'amru Mechabrei HaMusa. The books of Musa write, they say, Matovu HaChachma, how good is Chachma, Tiyapa Es HaMaisa. Because it perfects the, makes real the action. How real is the action? How good is the action? Because it makes real the wisdom. When a person is being trained to cross the street, so at the beginning when he looks both ways, or he doesn't cross the street, it's not because he's afraid of the cause of the reality. He's afraid, or he wants to satisfy his parents. It's because of his relationship to his parents. But as he gets older, it's the reality which makes him be careful when he's crossing the street, not his parents. Same thing in Torah. A person might learn Torah for lishma reasons. But as he starts understanding these true ideas, and he sees the truth of them,
So then he starts, then he does the act based on the reality. So therefore, and also, just like when you know, let's say for instance, you know you're going to die if you do something, you will not do it. So the same thing, or the same thing when you keep Torah, you keep Torah also when the mind sees the truth, so therefore you keep the action. That's what he means, that the when you the study of Torah brings to action. Now also when you act on it and you see the reality, how it works, and you see the system working, you see that it does work because you know the ideas, because since you're doing it based on reality, you know the system, you know how it works. So therefore when you act upon it, you see how it works, so that makes the idea more real to you. We're up to Pasuk Yud. It says, "Bnei, my son, im yifatucha chatam, if sinners persuade you, al tavei, don't come. Don't go along with them." The Rabbeinu Yonah says, "Ate yatzir la'avdil min." Now he warns you to separate from bad people because they will push you away. It pushes the person's heart from the true path. And you see that same thing, David HaMelech, when he started his Tehillim, he says, "Ashrei Esh, happy is the man who does not follow evil." And then afterward it says that in the Torah of God you should go. So he says, Lamadna, we learn from this that that a person should first separate from the evil path. Like the Moshe of Leitzim, that's the one group of evil. And afterwards, you should study Torah. Okay. The question is, why should you? In other words, we see from here that this is the order. That the order is you should first remove the evil, like it says, "Sume Rava Seito," turn from evil, then do good. Question is, why do you go in that order? The answer is, we want to say two reasons. One is, if you do the good, and you study the good, how to do the good, and you don't study how to undo the bad, practically you will be harmed. In other words, because you don't know how to protect yourself, so you will be harmed. But however, on the other hand, if you undo the bad first, okay, you're not doing the good, but at least you won't be harmed. You're not getting the benefits from the good, but at least you won't be harmed. Okay? There's also another thing, similar to, I don't know if it's... So an example of this idea is that if the city wants to, they have money to one or two choices. Either to fix the sewer system, or rebuild a broken down sewer system, or to build new buildings. You see? Now, if you build new buildings and you don't have a sewer system, that could be catastrophic when it breaks down. So therefore, you see that practically, if you don't undo the bad thing, then that's more catastrophic than not having the good thing. But there is also another reason why this is so. And that is because doing incorrect acts, every act that you do is based on a certain philosophy. A certain philosophy that you live by. In other words, like this. Let's say a person holds, you're not allowed to steal, but it's okay if you take a stamp, you need a stamp to mail a letter, take a stamp from where you work, from the office. Nobody really cares. You see? So that person's philosophy is not that stealing is wrong. That person's philosophy is where you could bypass the guilt, or either you could bypass the guilt, or you won't get a certain minimum. You're not going to get caught. You're not going to be in real trouble. So it's not. So the thing is that their philosophy is incorrect. If you're living the life of evil, if you have a positive life, and you're still acting according to the evil within you, you didn't undo the evil and the harm, so then the framework in which you're operating is a framework of evil. And therefore you must undo not only the bad actions, but you must also undo the framework in which you're operating so that you could start changing your framework. In other words, as you see that this framework is wrong, you see, so then you could start removing that framework and that philosophy, that view of life, to a new area, to a new view of life. But if you don't undo it, then the new view of life is just built on an incorrect philosophy. It's built on an incorrect framework, so therefore it really can't become a strong part of you. Now the question is do you have to wait to undo everything before you get the positive? No. First of all, you see that the whole book of Mishlei is written side by side, undoing evil and the positive. You see that there's a certain extent that you're moving simultaneously, but the emphasis should be on the undoing, not on the positive at the beginning. The emphasis should be on undoing the bad way. The question is, how do you know, let's say, for instance, you didn't undo a bad thing and you're working on a benefit, how do you know it's not corrupting the good thing? The answer is that all life is a development. And you are right. Sometimes you move in a certain direction or you look at life in a certain way, and then as you develop, you straighten out your hashkafa, your view of life. You straighten out how you look at it. So you're always developing. Now sometimes, you're right, you might have moved a little too fast with the positive, or you might have gained the positive while you're learning Mishlei, you're learning the positive and the negative practically simultaneously. So therefore, you might gain more in the positive, and it might not be 100% clear, but however, it's not a catastrophe. It's not like, let's say, studying, like we said before, studying philosophy before you develop your whole sense of truth and reality. That could destroy you. This type of thing is not going to destroy you. It could just, you'll just have an incorrect view of it, but slowly but surely you'll change that incorrect view. Okay, now what are these evil people going to talk you into? Now the first thing we come to, in Yomru Lecha, they say to you, go Lecha Itanu, go with us. And what are we going to do? Ne'erva L'dam, we're going to ambush person for blood. In other words, we're going to kill the guy. Mitzvah, we're going to hide L'naki to an innocent person, Chinam, for no reason. Okay? That's possible. But the question is that that's a very extreme example to get a guy to start from nothing to go murder somebody. You know what I mean? He says, don't let yourself be persuaded. Means that you're starting out in life, and you could go two ways. It's still open to you. The world is still open. Somebody says, well, let's go ambush somebody. We'll kill the guy. I mean, you're not going to just... what? It takes a long time before you remove your morals to such an extent, your morals and ethics to such an extent that you can murder somebody. You have to first start certain evil, and then you build up to that. Okay? So the question is what is the pasuk talking about? So Rabbeinu Yonah starts off that this parsha, this paragraph, is talking about stealing, not murder. But he makes a metaphor for stealing, makes the metaphor of murder. Just like our sages say that if somebody takes a penny from a poor person, it's as if he took a soul from him. So the question that we have to ask is, we're saying that stealing from a person metaphorically is murder, okay? Right, you can't say it's equal to murder. You're not taking the guy's life. He's still alive. So it must be some type of metaphor. We want to understand in what way stealing is equal to murder. Okay, Ian has two approaches. Okay, the first approach is that the dead person
has no desires and cannot fulfill anything. He cannot satisfy himself. So there is nothing to satisfy. But the poor person, since he cannot satisfy himself, he is equal to dead, because he can't satisfy any of his needs. That's equal to dead. You understand, what is life? Life is I have needs, and I satisfy these needs. But if I can't satisfy, so it's a metaphor in the sense that a dead person doesn't have two qualities. He doesn't have the need, so he can't satisfy it. But the poor person has the needs, but he can't satisfy it, so in a way, he's worse than the dead person. Because he has the needs, and he can't satisfy the needs. So when you take it away from take the money away from the poor person, you're making him equal to dead, because now he can't satisfy his needs. The second approach is that a person identifies himself. There's certain identification with the things that you have. You have a house. It's not just a place to live, but you identify yourself where the house is. Like if it's in a different part of the city, you identify yourself with the in crowd, the rich crowd. Another part is the lesser. You identify the way you dress. You dress like all the things that you own, it's a certain identification. Now, if you're a poor person, so you cannot create this identification for you. What is a dead person? A dead person is he has no more identification as a human. He has no more identification. So the poor person also cannot identify. He cannot identify himself through the material world. In other words, if you're talking about a tzaddik, so he identifies through chachma, wouldn't affect him. But most people. Most people identify psychologically, they identify through everyday life. Everyday life, people identify with the objects they buy and the objects they own. It affects who they are. In other words, when you dress, you have a certain projection that you're trying to project onto the world. It's your identity, how you project onto the world. You see? That the poor person doesn't have the ability to create this image and to create his identity. The Pasuk Yedeis says, Nivleim, we will swallow them, Kishol, like the grave, Chayim, alive, like the grave swallows a person alive, Usamimim, and Tamimim are a certain level of perfection, Kiyor Devor, like he goes down into the pit. I didn't finish Rabbeinu Yonah on Pasuk Yud Aleph. He says that we'll hide and wait for a Nucky. He says this teaches us that wicked people must hate an innocent person, and who's an innocent person? The tzaddik. Okay? He hates the tzaddik more than anybody else. And what's the translation of Naki? Innocent, he's innocent or clean of sin. Okay? And he says the same thing as the next pasuk, but it says Tamimim Kiyor Devor, says it's the same thing that Tamimim are also these tzaddikim. Okay? Now, the question is, why does he hate the tzaddik? Why does the wicked hate the tzaddik? Okay, for that we'll have to go on to your days. Okay, we already did the pasuk, so we'll do Rabbeinu Yonah. Says Nivleim Kishol Chayim. He says, and it'll be Kala is a jail. They'll be in prison, just like the grave closes around the dead and like imprisons them. That's the metaphor. Imprisons them. So an ani is equal to a dead, like we said before, and it imprisons him. When you take it away from him, it imprisons him, it puts them in this situation that he can't get out of, and he does not have any life in the two ways that we said before, like our sages said. Okay. So therefore, the thing is that that he's just saying the same thing, that the metaphor for the grave, that put him in the grave, is a metaphor for he's imprisoned, either that he can't, like when you're imprisoned, you can't satisfy your desires. The person in prison also can't satisfy his natural desires. And the same thing is he can't bring out his identity. He has to wear the same clothing. He's locked up there. He doesn't have his identity. So it's also being in prison is the same problem as being poor. Same type problem. Says these psukim teach us that the rasha, his nature, is to hate the naki and the tam. And who is the tam? The tam is on a higher level than the naki, like I will explain. But I would just like to give the difference between the naki and the tam, and then we'll see later also what he says on it. Okay. But the thing is, the naki is a person that keeps Torah and keeps justice, but however, he's still in conflict. Okay, that's the naki. While the tam is a person that has no conflict. Tam means perfect, complete. You see? So, in other words, the first guy keeps Torah and he sees the ideas, but his emotions still drawn the other way. He still thinks he would like to be wealthy, but he knows that it's wrong. His mind keeps controlling it, but he has the desires. And he realizes that these desires are incorrect, but he didn't undo the desire yet. That's one level. That's the naki. The tam, on the other hand, is a person that has no conflict. He removed the conflict. He reached a level where his emotions are in line with his ideas, and he doesn't have a conflict with his emotions. But the question is such a thing possible? How far you could go, whether it's totally possible or possible to a very high level, there is possibility, let's put it this way, definitely it's possible to lower your desire. Okay, that's definite. How much you could undo your total personality, I don't know if you can totally, or let's put it this way, it would be a rare person that could. Okay, that could totally undo his own desires to such an extent that it's non-existent. Like he doesn't have a Yetzirah. Say, he doesn't have any Yetzirah. You see, even the others, I mean, they had to, did they ever undo it after that last sin? Seems to be Yaakov, I mean, seems to have undid it. I mean, there seems to be one or two who undid it totally. But most of them have not undid their total personality. There's something left of their personality. Could be Moshe was supposed to be, I'm not sure. But practically for us, definitely, I mean, we're always going to have a certain level of our personality. And, we'll have to totally work on it. But to a certain extent, you can't undo it. What level will you use the term Tom? How much you have to undo to use the term Tom? That I don't know. And maybe we'll see later, maybe. He'll be able to explain it, maybe he'll set us up. But I can't define that. But there is a point, but definitely, there is a point of undoing and lowering the level of your desires. And it comes in line with the ideas. How much you could do, I don't know. And at what point you call the Tom, I don't know. Now he says that the nature of fire is to hate its opposite. Now, that's definitely a metaphor, right? Because fire does not hate. So what the question is, what's the metaphor? In other words, the terminology of the mashal, of the example, of the metaphor, is that fire hates its opposite. Okay? Now, what do you mean it hates its opposite? Shouldn't he use the word, what does he mean by hate? He means something in the physical world. He means something by hate. What does he mean by hate, Christopher?
Fire doesn't hate. Fire doesn't have emotion.
What the metaphor means is that fire cannot, the two opposites cannot exist at the same time in the same place. Cannot exist. Okay, it means fire cannot exist with its opposite, and its opposite cannot exist with fire. Now the question is, then the Rabbeinu Yonah says, and the same thing is written, Anche Damim Yisnu Tam. That's written further on in Mishlei. Okay? So the question, so he's using the same terminology. So the question is, what does it mean, Anche Damim Yisnu Tam? It means that two people with opposite personalities cannot exist together. Well, I don't know what that means. I mean, it could be, why can't they? In other words, insofar as fire and let's say water, that I could understand. I understand what it means, cannot exist. But the question is, why cannot evil, an evil person, exist with the tzaddik? That's the question. In other words, what's the quality of the Rasha that he cannot live with the tzaddik? What's the quality of the tzaddik that he cannot live with the Rasha? I just want to repeat what you're saying, Joey. In other words, he's saying like this, that each one has what they think is the best life, right? So if each one has the best life, so why should one be jealous of the other? Why should one, I mean, I have a good life. I think I have the best life. So why should I be jealous of you? Why should I hate you? I mean, I have the good life. Why should I hate you? Because the reason why they can't live with each other, because the tzaddik sees that the life of the Rasha is totally destructive, will totally destroy his life. And the Rasha sees that the life of the tzaddik will destroy his life. Also, the tzaddik sees that the philosophy of the Rasha is to destroy his society and his way of life. And the Rasha sees that the philosophy of the tzaddik, philosophy that will totally destroy his life. Okay? In other words, they see, each one sees the other one, that his lifestyle is destructive to his lifestyle, and that his philosophy is totally destructive to his lifestyle. In other words, the Rasha sees that if the tzaddik advocates righteousness, and he shows that that's the best life, he's undermining the life of the Rasha, saying the life of the Rasha is nothing. In other words, you don't have to tell him. I mean, it's just that he recognizes that it's totally contrary. He sees that his life is totally contrary and destructive to his life. You see? The tzaddik definitely sees the wicked, that's definitely destructive to the society and his whole way of life, tries to undermine all that way of life. So therefore, there's a hatred from both sides, for the tzaddik to the Rasha, and the Rasha to the tzaddik. After this, the Rabbeinu Yonah says that it's important to, the reason why we must teach these pesukim, what's the benefit of teaching this pesukim? We must teach them to a child, okay, and an adult too, so they shouldn't trust the words of the wicked that speak against the tzaddik, right? And try to degrade the books of righteousness. When the listener knows that it is the nature of the wicked that they should hate the tzaddik, then he understands the high level of the tzaddik that hates the Rasha, and that the Rasha must speak about him falseness. Okay? So he's saying that when you start out in life, you must recognize, you must be careful, because the Rasha is going to try and show you why the life of the tzaddik is a bad life, why it's a terrible life. He's going to write books and show how it's a terrible life. And he's going to ask questions against that life to show that that's a bad life. So you must start off by showing the life of the wicked, that two things. One, that the life is a bad life, that it's not a good life, but you must also show the motive of the wicked.
question is, why is it so important? If I know the life of the wicked is wrong, why is it so important to show the motive also? Why is that so? It's inherently important to show the motive. The answer is, when you see what's wrong, so you understand what's wrong. But when you see the motive, you see the source of his philosophy. You see the source of his philosophy is based on his whole personality and his whole motive, and that it's not based on reality. See, there's two things. One, I look at reality, and I see his philosophy doesn't fit into reality. That's one thing. But then the second thing I also see is that his whole philosophy, not only is it not based on reality, but it's based on his personality, and all his motives are in line with his philosophy, stems from his philosophy stems from his motive. So therefore, that makes it, when you see that, that makes it more real to you that the whole philosophy of the Rasha is worthless, and you should not take his ideas to heart, whatever ideas he talks against the Tzaddik. He says also, what you could learn from this pasuk is the great sin of Gezel, because they compare it to Shvichas Dam, okay? That the pasuk holds that it's so terrible because of, you compare it to murder, right? Okay. The question is, okay, so now that I know that, so what is he teaching me? In other words, I understand. Even let's say I didn't compare it to Shvichas Dam. I mean, stealing is bad. You understand? Stealing is bad. So let's say I say stealing is bad. So it's also why I should teach you that. I mean, made it to a higher level. You understand? But what is he teaching me? He means that this pasuk is teaching me something. It's unbelievable. What is he teaching me? Right. When they have a hostage situation, the method of saving the people in a hostage situation is not to try to get them out. On the contrary, you try and keep them there and keep them talking. The reason for this is that the hostage, the person that's holding the people hostages, should identify with his hostages. Once you identify with them, you can't destroy them. You see? Now, the person that steals from somebody, he cannot identify with the person he's destroying. And he cannot understand, and it doesn't enter his mind, what he's doing to the other person. He doesn't think in those terms. This type of person only thinks about how I feel. I feel good? Fine. I steal from the other person, I got money, I feel good. That's all that's important. I don't think or identify in terms of the other person. If he does identify, he won't be able to steal from him. Okay? We're saying that if you recognize what you're doing to the other person, you stop and think what it means. That it means if you steal from a person, you are taking away every satisfaction. Anything, the reason why it's worth being a human is because you satisfy your needs. You have certain needs and you satisfy them. That is why it's worth being a human, when you can satisfy your needs. So you take away that. And if you take away his identity, then there's absolutely no life. What if the guy, I mean, he feels like a nothing. You can imagine, you felt you have no identity who you are. You see, when you recognize that, in other words, when we say that we compare to murder, we're saying that teaches us a certain quality, how to look and how to view the person that's being robbed. How you look at the person, what's truly happening to them. Most times, it's unjust to take money because he owns it, so it's unjust to take it away. That's the halachic viewpoint. But when you look at it from the Musa viewpoint, you see the nature of what you're truly doing to the person. When you recognize the destruction of doing to another person, then that becomes a motive for not stealing. In other words, one thing is the halachic reason I should not steal. oh, well, if we God told me I shouldn't feel, it's wrong. But the other is when I see the destruction. And the method of seeing the destruction is using murder as a metaphor and seeing the motive of what I have, not the motive, what I've destroyed in the other person. Not only just taking the money that doesn't have money, but there's no satisfaction, there's a loss of identity. You see, when you look at life that way, then that will say, understand the reason why God said you should not steal. Then you can understand the reason why God said you should not steal, and that will help you to said not to do the act of stealing. We're in the Rabbeinu Yonah Pasuk Tetzav. He says, "V'ni al teilech v'derech itam." Don't go on the road with them. Don't go on their fair ways. Insofar as they advise you to go on to rob, don't go with them. Stop your feet. You should also stop yourself from going when they're dealing with other things other than robbery. They do other things besides robbery, right? You know, whatever they do. Says don't go with them also. Let's say, for instance, you say, look, I don't rob, but these guys are nice guys. I like hanging out with them. Okay? So I'll hang around with them when they're not going out on a robbery. Okay? He says, don't do that. Therefore it says, stop your feet from going, or prevent your feet from going. You shouldn't even hang around with them, since they are people that are sinners. Maybe by chance they will pass something to steal, and they'll rob, or they'll do damage. These type of people sometimes like to hurt people, so they'll see somebody will try and hurt them, or any other type of sin. But since they're involved in sins, they'll do many different types of sins, not only robbery. And since you're there, they'll persuade you to sin with them, and you'll be punished, even though your heart protests. And you want to admonish them, right? Still in all, in other words, you're in conflict. Okay, you should not go with them because you will be punished because you're going to do the wrong thing. Says the first thing is, even if you don't desire to do it, once you're with them, it's very hard. There's an emotion to be part of the crowd. To be in, especially since you enjoy being with them, so you don't want to lose their friendship. So a lot of people, sometimes people think things are wrong, but once they get involved, the emotion takes over. You can't think at that moment. When you're in a certain, especially with the group is all doing something, they're all excited, they're all worked up, you see? So that emotion gets you to want to do it also. And even though you're in conflict about it, but you'll still do it. You see? That is the first step of sinning. Is when you're in a situation, the situation draws you in. See what he's saying? Don't get into the situation. Because when you're first starting out, if you get into the situation will draw you in. And that will be the first step of sin. Even though you're in conflict and you don't want to do it, and everything in you is screaming, yelling, don't do it, run away, tell them off, scream at them, just get out of there. But you can't anymore. You just can't, because you're in the situation, and since you don't have the... some people all their lives will never have the ability to pull out. I mean, there's a rare Avram that could go among the wicked, and he's totally protected by his lifestyle, by his ideas. That's a rarity. So therefore, you have to. We can't do that, and we have to stay out of those situations that draw us in, and where we'll be totally destroyed. Even though we'll be in conflict, we'll do the thing. That's the first step.
Okay? And that's what he says afterwards. Says, Gamian Asha, he who hangs around the Russia and goes in there in the heels, in other words, follows them, because the beginning steps habituate to sin. The beginning steps is becoming a bit, is the first step is you do it, and then it starts becoming a natural thing. In other words, first it's not habitual. It's just doing the act. Then it's the most natural thing. You know, later on, in 5 years, you won't even have a conflict. You'll do it. It's the most natural thing. So therefore, the first step in sinning is the first act of sinning is the problem, you see. And then afterwards, then it becomes habit forming. And once it becomes habit forming, then it becomes a lifestyle. But the first step is the act. You do the act, and there are certain situations. There are certain situations that force you to do the act, and you just can't get out of it once you're in that situation. As now Chazal say that he who subordinates or follows sinners is like the sinner. And it's also say when you are friendly with the Russia, God made a breach in your actions. Okay? Question is, what does Chazal mean? You didn't, just hanging around them, just following them is not sinning. Why is that a breach already? You want to say that it's wrong to do it, even though it's not a sin, and like a tachana, they're telling you not to do something to protect you from the end result. Okay, but that would be true if they said don't do it for the end result, because of what's going to happen. Like we just said, don't get into a situation because if they decide to sin. Once you're in that situation, it's very hard to get out. Yeah, we're talking about even though you didn't sin, you just hang around with them. You're just friendly with them. You go to places with them. Go to movies with them. You like to talk with them. You understand? It says here that he already, God made a breach insofar as your action with your actions. God made a breach. Porat Hashem es ma'asach. God made a breach. That means there's something wrong already. So the question is, what is wrong? You didn't do anything wrong, so what's wrong? Let me ask you a different question. When you see criminals and you want to hang around with them, question is, even if you don't want to be a criminal, right, you don't want to be a criminal, what's the nature of a person that will want to hang around with a criminal even though you don't want to do criminal acts? This type of person is a person that sees the lifestyle of the criminal as the best life, as the good life. He sees something good. He can't do it, but he sees it as the good life. He sees it as the good life. If you see that, the good life, and you feel you want to be with these people because they have the good life, that personality is already has made a breach with God. God has made a breach with them. Because then, what it means, God has made a breach, which means you have made the breach with God. You have made a breach, you have turned away from God, because you recognize that lifestyle as a beneficial lifestyle. Hanging around people just shows it's a barometer of measuring who you identify with, who you think is important, who you want to hang around with, you see? So once you're that type of person, that is So therefore, that why if you ready made to preach, it'll just take a certain amount of time till you start doing their types of actions, because that's really a desire. But right now, something is stopping you, some guilt, some fear, I don't know, whatever it is, you see? But that will be undone by constantly hanging around them, you see? The question is that a sin? No, because the answer is, if you ask me halachically, is that a sin? The answer is no. You didn't halachically have to enact. But if you ask me according to the world of Musa, whether that is a sin, yes. Because you see, it says God made a breach, meaning your desires, your framework, what you hold as the good in this world is contrary to what the Torah holds the good is. So therefore, the Rabbeinu Yonah ends off that it's not necessary to warn us against robbing, okay? Because a beginner is not going to go out to rob. You know what I mean? What? But he has to warn you not to hang around these people. Now he says, this is very important, he says, V'dai, no, which means he's saying, listen carefully, this is big. That this is a cornerstone, or the foundation of the fear of God, is to separate from hanging around wicked people. The question is, why is this the cornerstone of Yiras Hashem? The first question is what is Yiras Hashem? What do we say Yiras Hashem is? The fear of consequences, okay? So first of all, let's understand what's happening here. You are a beginner, which means that you have all the regular desires of a normal human being. A normal human being is awakened. It has all the regular desires, all the basic desires, right? And if you recognize that certain desires lead to evil, there's certain situations that lead to evil, so you have to stay away from it. Is that correct? So this is definitely part of Yiras Hashem, hanging around this people. But the question is, so therefore it is part of Yiras Hashem, and hanging around these people. The question is, because you get the consequence, the question is, why is this a cornerstone? In other words, we see that it is part of Yiras Hashem. It fits in very well with Yiras Hashem. This is an idea of fear of God, because you see the consequences. What are the consequences? By understanding your personality, and that all you need is a situation to bring out the harm, so that will destroy you. So therefore, you should stay out of the situation. That I can understand is part of Yiras Hashem. Question is, why is it a cornerstone of Yiras Hashem? Let me clarify the question. I'm saying that this statement is part of Yiras Hashem. I'm saying that the reason why you should not hang around the person is because of the consequences, the way we explain, right? Now, therefore I understand that this is part, a particular about Yiras Hashem. Question is, why is it a cornerstone? There are two types of consequences. Let's say, for instance, a person talks Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is not contrary to the idea of my studying. It's not contrary to Yiras Hashem. What I mean is that I am doing the wrong thing. I will get the consequences, but I could watch myself in other areas. But there are certain traits that there's certain acts that are that take away the ability to work on Yiras Hashem. You see? In other words, like this, there's certain things that are against Yiras Hashem. You do the act and you will get the consequences. You pay the price. But that act is not contrary to you
studying Yiras Hashem and understanding what Yiras Hashem is, you see? But however, there's certain acts like this one, like this act, that if you hang around these people, it will affect you in such a way, it will affect you in such a way that it will take away all the ability to get involved in the world of Yiras Hashem, the whole world of Yiras Hashem. Is that, you understand? In other words, there's certain ones that you will get the consequences, but it doesn't remove your ability to work on your Hashem and then slowly be able to do it. But over here, by hanging around these people, it will affect you in such a way that you will not be able to work on your Hashem. It takes away your ability to work on the whole system of your Hashem, the idea of Yiras Hashem. It precludes that idea. That's why it's a cornerstone. According to Rabbeinu Yonah, basically he wants to say that the next pasuk is pretty similar to what we just said. It says that Kiragleim l'ra yirutzu, that their feet run to evil and they're quick to spill blood. So basically, the Rabbeinu Yonah wants to say that Tezayin, Pasuk Tezayin, Tezvav, is similar. Same idea. Pasuk Tezayin. It says, Kifina Mezora Horeshes Beinei Kol Balkona. In the eyes of the bird, the bait is for free. The bait in the trap is for free. He only sees the bait, but he doesn't see the trap behind the bait. So he thinks he could swoop down and get the bait. You see, the food. He doesn't look at it as bait. He looks at it as food, but he doesn't realize it's bait. You see, that's the difference. Now he's saying he's telling the person that you have to be careful about sin, about following these people. Now, the Rabbeinu Yonah Pasuk Yud Zayin is basically saying like this. There are two types of people. There's one person that sees an evil act as a good. He sees it totally as the good and a benefit, and he doesn't see anything wrong with it. Rabbeinu Yonah says that no, even a person that knows there are consequences, that's what he means by dinu mishpat. Dinu mishpat means there are consequences in this world. Okay? And he believes there's a shofet, there's a judge that judges everybody. Okay? And he calls this person a rasha. He accepts these ideas, but yet at the moment of taiva, the moment of desire, when the desire is awakened, at that moment he forgets the consequences. He doesn't recognize. He uses the word forget, that he forgets the consequences of what he knew, not what he knew at another moment. Like, for instance, let's say, for instance, you realize you shouldn't scream at your parents. In a moment of anger, they do something, at that moment when that desire takes over, so you yell and scream at them, right? At that moment, you do not see the consequences of your actions. You only see that that's the right thing, and the consequences are closed off. The question is what's the mechanism and how does it work? But the question that we're asking is, what's the nature of a person? What's the nature of a person that, what is the nature of people that when their desires take over, they totally remove all the consequences that could happen, which before their desires took over, they consciously know, they could tell you exactly what the consequences and why you shouldn't do it. And they don't do it. But as soon as the emotion takes over, at that moment, they're totally blinded to the consequences, and they do that act. Question is, how does that work within the human being? How does that work? How does it work?
Even if he knows it 100%, and he lives by the idea, when that emotion takes over, at that moment, that idea is not real. He totally negates the consequences. He doesn't think of the consequences. Says if he's like a different person. Says if for that moment, when the desire is there, says if it doesn't exist, it's not real. Then afterwards, once the emotion passes, you'll ask him, was that right? He'll say, no, it's totally wrong, and I'll pay the consequences. But at that moment, the consequences take over. Question is, how does this work? The question is, why does this phenomenon happen, that a person that knows something, he knows there's consequences, the fact, and he knows this exact situation, there are consequences, When the taiva takes over, when the desire takes over, the consequences are totally forgotten. The question is, how does it work in the human psyche? There are two parts to the human, okay? There's his conscious mind and his unconscious mind, okay? We know there's certain things in a human being, like, for instance, let's say consciously you feel one way, unconsciously you feel another. Now, even though you don't do the unconscious way, the unconscious has a way of showing up. It sneaks into the mind. You say the wrong thing, like you make a slip. You say the wrong thing. Where does that come from? You say the unconscious. The unconscious has a certain level of control over the conscious. Okay? When the desire has totally taken over, it means that the unconscious at this moment is in control. And the unconscious does not see consequences. The unconscious only sees desire, only knows desire. It is the conscience or the mind which will tell you what about consequences. But the emotion, the desire, does not recognize consequences. And when that part of the person is in control of the human at that moment, the other components are closed off. The other components are not working. He closes off the conscious mind, closes off the conscience, which is the guilt and the fear. He closes off all these things. So therefore, the only thing that is working at this point is the unconscious desire. It has the ability, the unconscious part of the human being, what we call the HRA, has the ability to close off other functions of the mind. And that takes over and closes off functions of the other mind. And therefore, at that moment, all other parts are closed off. So therefore, that's the mashal of it. It says, like the bird sees the bait, but doesn't see the trap. And the moment that a desire takes over, even if you have the knowledge of the consequences, at that moment, the consequences are closed off. And you don't see that you're walking into a trap, that you will pay the consequences, because it closes off the other parts of the mind and doesn't allow the other parts of the mind to work. We'd just like to go over the result of the pasuk. We said, what's the function? How does it work that you could forget? The Rabbeinu Yonah says you forget. The question is, how does you forget? So we want to say that the unconscious, which is a place, it's unconscious. What it means unconscious, it means it's an area that you refuse to look at. You refuse to see. And therefore, you're not aware that it's operating because you refuse to look at it. Okay? So therefore, now that part of you has the ability to close off the conscious mind, you see? So even if you have knowledge of the truth, of the consequences, so it has the ability to close off the knowledge. Also, the conscience is a part of the unconscious, and the animalistic desire has ability to close off the conscience. So therefore, when a desire is awakened, how it operates, how you're able to operate,
it closes off any part of the human that that interferes with its desire. In other words, if it's logical consequences, then it closes that off. If it's the conscience, like you have certain guilts or certain fears, it can close that off. In other words, you, before the act, you just go into the act that closes off the consequences. Immediately after the act, the conscience makes you feel guilty because the desire is not there anymore after the act. So after the act, you feel guilty about the act, you see? So you see that the animalistic part of you has the ability to close off at that moment, to close off different parts of you so that it could operate. It has the ability to close off anything that will stop, not all the time, but that's one of the things it has. It has that ability to close off different functions that stop it from operating. Okay? The question is, why do we have to talk about the unconscious? Why don't you just say you have an animalistic desire and it just comes out? But the question is that why does it forget? Ramayana says that you forget the information of the consequences, or you forget your guilt that would stop you from doing it. Now, what do you mean you forget? What is forgetting? The answer is forgetting means that you close off that information for the moment. And after you do the act, and that desire, and you satisfy that desire, then afterwards the other areas are opened again, and therefore you either feel guilty or you feel bad, whatever the however you feel about these things. When the Rabbeinu Yonah uses the word forgetting in this situation, it's descriptive. There is certain times you forget things. You prepared for a test and you forgot things. That could be something totally different. Okay? I'm just saying the idea of forgetting in this case means that you close off a part of your mind. The question is, could the conscience do the same thing to the animalistic part of you? Right? The conscience. Right? The answer is yes. Sometimes the guilt is so strong that it closes off certain desires, and you deny that you have the desire altogether. Sometimes completely, and sometimes in certain situations where the conscience is awakened. The tools of the conscience is threefold, namely guilt, fear, and shame. The question is practically, you shouldn't allow the unconscious to work. The answer is that there are two things. One is you must know the truth. Like in this case, you must know that if you go against Torah, there will be consequences. There are consequences, and you should know what the consequences are, right? Then you have to investigate the unconscious so that to make sure that it doesn't interfere and stop you from thinking about the consequences. In other words, there to undo the effects of the unconscious is an investigation of the unconscious itself. To stop the animalistic part of you from closing off the idea of consequences. Sometimes, when that part of that animalistic part of you is very strong, so then you must make an investigation of the animalistic part of you, so as to deal with it. And as you see it, so then you, as you bring it to the conscious mind, as you remove it, that it's unconscious, you see, and you're able to view it. So then it doesn't have the effect on you that it could close off the conscious mind, and that it closes off the idea of consequences when you go against the ideas of Torah. Even where the conscience controls the animalistic part of you, you see, That is not the best way of controlling the animalistic part. The best way of controlling the animalistic part is through the knowledge of Torah, through ideas of Torah, the ideas itself. The question is, why is that better? The answer is because as long as it's unconscious, then it could go to extremes. In other words, like, for instance, the Inquisition was based on a conscience. You know what I mean? Like a very powerful religious, they controlled their, they controlled their personal desires for the conscience of their religion. And they were able to kill people in the name of God. You say, that's a dangerous thing. Once you go from the conscience, you could go to extremes in that area too. Therefore, the best way is through the study of Torah and to get the exact lines, exactly how far is correct to go and how far is incorrect to go. V'heim l'damam yerovu, and they make an ambush for their blood, and yitzvanu they hide, but not show some for their lives. Now, what the pasuk doesn't explain is what the pronouns are. Okay, we understand who's setting up the ambush, but it doesn't say who's being caught in the ambush. Okay, so the Rabbeinu Yonah relates it back to pasuk Yud Zayin. He says, just like the birds see the trap, see only the bait, and they don't notice the trap, you see, and they don't stop because it doesn't prevent them from going after the bait, right? So therefore it's the trap is spread out for the lives of who? The lives of the bird that doesn't know the trap. Right? So he says the same thing. He doesn't say that, he leaves that to you, but basically he means that the real trap is set out for the person that doesn't see the consequences. In other words, when he tries to rob people and destroy others, he doesn't recognize that it was set up for his own, that he gets the consequences. That the consequences is totally, that the trap that he's setting up is his own trap. His ambush which he's setting up is his own ambush, not the ambush of, I mean, it's true he's hurting others along the road. But however, he will get the consequences, and a large part of Mishlei will show you the different consequences of the person that closes off or doesn't study Mishlei and doesn't see the consequences of his actions. So therefore, he will fall into these traps, and he will be hurt. Cain, so is Orchos, the way of Kolbotzei Abotza, that go for ill-gotten gains, that goes for gains, that is driven by gains, so that they do it illegally. The soul of its owners is taken, or the life of the owner is taken. Okay? That's the pasuk, and this is the last pasuk of this idea. Now, after this, he starts a new idea. Okay? However, the Rabbeinu Yonah says that he forgets when he has this pleasure, is awakened for his goal, for his profits, he forgets the consequences. You see, he forgets the consequences. So he says, the pasuk says, "It's nefesh ba'olav yikach." The life of its owner will be taken. He says, because sometimes he is punished by death through the hands of God, according to the tsar, according to the pain and nezek and harm that he inflicted on the person that he stole from. Okay? Question is, what does that mean? And then he says, even though it has not been, that this punishment is not explained in Torah. Right? So the question is, what does he mean by that? Maybe it's not written in Torah, then how does he get this information altogether? Another question is when he says, damn lady, he says, V'yesh mefarshim, the last three lines, he says, V'heim l'damim yarovu, harishom ha'ovrim l'dam, the rishayim that ambush for blood, v'tzofnim l'naki, and they hide. Well, tzofnim over here also means to ambush for an innocent person, l'dam, to kill him, l'dam. So he says, l'dam, I'm sorry, l'naki, for an innocent, l'dam atzmam yarovu. With their own blood, they are ambushing. They're ambushing themselves. So the question is, what is the difference between that and what he said before? Same answer. What's the difference? Right. He says, the difference between the first answer and the second answer is the first answer is by hashkacha. That's what I mean, misa bidei shamayim. And what he means is that it's not been explained in Torah, this punishment. In other words, the punishment is not explained openly, like many times you do something wrong, so the Torah tells you exactly what you get. But here, it's slightly different. Here it's slightly different. We'll explain in a minute. But the difference between the first answer and the second answer is the first answer is dealing hashkacha, and the second answer is dealing in the laws of nature. What's the difference between the consequences in the laws of nature and reward and punishment insofar as hashkacha is concerned? How does it work? What's the difference in the way it works? The laws of nature is you do certain acts that bring about certain consequences in the laws of nature, right? But however, hashkacha pratis is, in other words, God evaluates exactly how much the person, the victim, how much he was hurt, and your punishment is in accordance with the pain and harm that is caused upon the victim. That no court can do, and the consequences in the laws of nature is not based on the level of, and evaluated on the level of the harm and pain that is brought about to the victim. That's what it means it's not been explained in Torah. What it means it's not been explained in Torah that that's a particular thing of the, of exactly each person is different. In other words, for one type of sin, for one type of pain, or a certain level of pain that you cause, you get this consequence. Each situation, God evaluates should your consequence be based on the pain and harm that you did to the victim. You see? Laws of nature is more general, that if you do a certain act, that act will bring about on you certain consequences. You see? For instance, the laws of nature, let's say a person harms somebody. Well, he might get a consequence for that, he might not. Or he might not get his consequence till he harms 20 people, and the 20 people get together, or they, you know what I mean, and they do something to you. In other words, it's not a measured by the pain of the victim, but the consequences brought about by different situations. In other words, sometimes you could harm one person, that the person will take vengeance immediately and destroy you. Sometimes it'll take 20 people. So one person will harm 20 people, and he'll get the same consequence as the person that harmed one person. Makes no difference how much harm he brought about on the victim. It's just that, you know, suddenly he got his consequence. In other words, certain people get caught after the first time they do something. Certain people get caught after the 20th or the 50th time. I mean, it's just the circumstances that brings it about that he's going to get caught. But when it's Hashgacha Pratis, the consequence is brought about by an exact measurement of the pain of the pain of the victim, or the harm to the victim.
Pasuk Chav starts a new subject. He says, Chochmos b'chutz Torona. Wisdom cries cries aloud outside. Rechovos, in the marketplaces, titein kola, it utters its voice. Okay? Now, the Rabbeinu Yonah says that he calls this the third parsha, and he says that this third parsha had to come before the fourth, because what he said before, like we discussed before, that that undoing the negative, undoing the bad traits, comes before getting positive traits. Says now the fourth parsha deals with positive traits, while this parsha is dealing with negative traits. Okay, so therefore this parsha must come before the fourth parsha. Okay, now he says that what the pasuk means is that learning is not only in the synagogue, but learning is also out in public places, okay? And therefore, the person that gives talchacha should not only give talchacha to the in the synagogues and yeshivas, you know, but he should also give it on the outside where the public gathers. He should go out there like the early Nevi'im used to do. They used to go out to the public places to give Musar and Telchacha to the public. All right, the question is, where's the first Parsha, the second Parsha? Because since he's talking about the third and fourth, where's the first? First and second. First is basically an introduction speaking to who he's talking to, what's the purpose of the book, what's the method that he uses. The second parasha deals with the basic foundation. You're going to make it, then you have to be careful who you hang around with. That comes first, even before you start studying, because that could destroy you before even you get started. Okay? Now he starts, this is the third parasha, he starts with the foolish way and the harmful way, that how you can be hurt by the bad traits that you have. That is the third parsha. Okay? The fourth parsha will be something more positive, how to gain knowledge, the positive part, in the importance of gaining knowledge and wisdom. Right, getting back to our subject is is that we should go to the outside and give talchacha and guide people there, not only in the shuls and yeshivas, but also outside also. Question is, why not? Why does he have to tell me that for? Of course you should go wherever the people are that need it. That's where you should do it. Why does he have to tell me this? That's what the Rabbeinu Yonah says. B'yesh ala mochichem la'ashmiya divrayim berchovos. It's upon those that that guide others to bring their words into the marketplaces of the city. Okay, in the streets, in the marketplaces, in any place that people gather there, so that they should hear the words, they should make the public, cause the public to hear the words of truth, and Musar, and Telchacha. Right, the question is what does this have to do with the third parsha? Since this is an introduction to the third parsha, so the answer is that there are people that are fools that are that you have to educate. So he's saying that you should educate them wherever they are.
You see? Right? So therefore, he's saying that you should educate them wherever they are. That's what he's saying. That's what it has to do with the third parsha. To educate people against the desires that bring about their consequences in harm. In other words, the third parsha is where you should learn, if you're learning Mishlei, then you should learn not to be a fool. But as an introduction, he tells those people that are teaching it, that reached the level of teaching it, you see, that he should go out and teach it both in the Beis Medrash and also in the public. Okay? So then he wants to say that that if you come to the Beis Medrash, so then I know that you want to learn. But what about if you, like we said before, there's only certain type of fools that you're allowed to teach. You're not allowed to teach every fool. So the way I could tell is if he comes to the Beis Medrash. But if he stays out in the street, so that means he doesn't want to learn. Right? Ah. So the thing is that he's saying there are people out there that might be able to, if you awaken in them the desire to come to the Beis Medrash. There are people out there that maybe you can't go into detail as you do in the Beis Medrash. And therefore, if a person comes to the Beis Medrash, that's one type of education. But there's another type of education that you give to the whole public and hope to reach out for those people that could learn, that have the ability to learn. It's like two different types of education. One is an intense development because the person comes to learn, so you give them an intense development. The other is you show them a area of knowledge that will awaken their desire to learn. So for those that would have the ability to really learn, if you awaken their desire, they will come to the Beis Medrash to go further. But then the others, they won't. They'll just go their way. So therefore, you must try to educate you must do it in the public, even though he's only saying that you should do it in both places. But what you're trying to accomplish, it must be different in one place over the other. Pasuk Chaf Aleph is a continuation of Chaf. It says, V'rosh Amir Sikri V'Pisrei Shorim, V'yam Oreo Tomer. I mean, this is said all over. Pasuk Chaf Beis. Says at Mosai Pesoyim Tehavu Pesi. How long will the Pesi love his type of foolishness? The Leitzim Lotzon Chamdu Lahem. And the Leitzim, their language, their speaking, do they desire? Uchsilim and fools, Yisnu Do'as, they hate knowledge. The Rabbeinu Yonah is going to answer two questions. One is, what's the difference between the three type of fools? And two, why one says that he loves, one desires, and one hates knowledge. What's the difference between those three? It says, Pesi is a person, third line in the Rabbeinu Yonah. It says, a Pesi is a weak-minded person. Now, weak-minded, he doesn't mean a low IQ. What he means is that he can be persuaded by people that teach him to make mistakes. That's what weak-minded means, that his views are dependent on others and he can't separate. He can't say, well, one minute, maybe this guy's view is wrong. He's easily persuaded to false ideas. And he says, also included in the Pesi are people that have wrong, incorrect ideas, incorrect philosophies, incorrect views
of life. That's the second type of passing. And the third type are people that desire false views because they think that they want certain desires, and because of these desires they set up their philosophy to fit into their desires, and they do not see the consequences. By chova, he means the consequences of his desire. And all this is a weakening of the mind. What he means by weakening of the mind, that means that he's persuaded to ideas that cannot stand up to clear-cut the rationale, to questioning and to argumentation. Can't stand up to it, but they're persuaded by weak ideas. Okay? So the question is, and then it weakens their the strength of their thought. See, not some of their thought or their intellect. Weakens their thought. What it means, it weakens their thought. They don't think in terms of logic. They only think in terms of being persuaded. Okay? They are persuaded into their views. Okay? The only question is what is the second one? There are sometimes you're persuaded by other people, and sometimes you're persuaded by your own desires. That's the first and third type of fantasy. But the middle type of fantasy, he just says that they have wrong views. Question is, where does he get his incorrect views? And how? And in what way is he being persuaded? In other words, when we say persuaded, he's either persuaded by people, right? He has a weak, he has weak emotions, so he's, he listens to others. Or two, his emotions affect his philosophy. In other words, his philosophy is based on his emotional makeup. But the Pesi does have a philosophy of life. He has a philosophy of life. But the way that his philosophy comes about is he's persuaded either by his Yetzera, or he's persuaded by others to for incorrect philosophy. Question is, what's the middle one that the Rabbeinu Yonah says? That he says, also included in the Pesi are people that they have incorrect views. One possibility is that they had these ideas from youth, from childhood on. So you could say they're persuaded by their, because they received it in infancy, so they're persuaded by their parents, and they can't get out of being affected by their parents' view. In other words, some people are persuaded by people around them, anybody. Some people are persuaded from youth by the way they were raised, certain ideas that they must accept those ideas, and they can't change. You see? And then that's it. They can't change from those ideas. That's why he just says, like, as if we don't know where it came from. He says that the Pesi has people that have wrong ideas. Where'd they get the wrong ideas? So it could be from youth that they got it. And the third one, they're persuaded by their emotions. Okay, those are the three ways that the Pesi becomes persuaded by his something outside of him, but not by outside of his intellect, and he's not persuaded by his intellect. Okay? So the Pesi is the person that has a philosophy, but his philosophy is not based on his mind, but his philosophy is based on something persuading his mind to have a certain view, certain idea. But he talks about it as if it is an idea, you know, as if he's talking ideas. But however, it does not come from ideas. Therefore, he calls it weak-minded, because it doesn't come from the ideas. It comes from one of three other sources. He says, in these three, since they're drawn by other things, says if they chose, if they refused not to follow their desire, and that would straighten out their philosophy. The whole incorrectness of their philosophy is because they're persuaded by one of, either they're weak in so far as other people, what other people say. They don't see anything wrong. They always accept it. Or they were raised that way, so that becomes, they can't think contrary to the way they were raised. Or they have certain desires that the desire affects their philosophy. In other words,